Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Listen to amazing and bizarre science infuse into your brain. I'm Ian Wolf. On this edition, we'll feature sexy smells, suicidal sexuality, and slowing senescence. But first up, here's the news. Discovery News reports that a team of researchers led by Lulu Kwan from the Californian Institute of Technology have developed a simple artificial brain out of DNA molecules. When quizzed, the brain answered questions correctly. Before brains with neurons evolved, single-celled organisms still had to use low-level intelligence. Without brains, they had molecules that interacted with each other and spurred the creatures to search for food and avoid toxins. So, molecules can process and transmit information and compute data. Kwan and her team created four highly simplified artificial neurons in test tubes made of just over 100 strands of DNA, each strand programmed with a specific sequence of bases to interact with other strands. The interactions resulted in yes or no outputs, mimicking the actions of neurons firing. The scientists attached a fluorescent molecular marker that lit up when the DNA answers were activated. The researchers played a trivia game with the neural network to see if it could identify one of four scientists based on a series of yes or no questions. Basic information related to the identity of the scientists was given to the test tube DNA brain in the form of encoded strands of DNA. To quiz the brain, a human player placed DNA strands that hinted at the answer into the test tube. With these clues, the neural network was able to produce the correct answer, which was visible thanks to the fluorescent markers. So the network could also communicate when it lacked enough information to correctly identify one of the scientists, or if any of the clues contained contradictory information. The research team played this game using 27 possible ways of answering questions, and the neural network in the test tube answered correctly each time. The team published their results in the July 21st, 2011 issue of the journal Nature. AirDrop is taking water out of thin air using solar and wind power. A turbine intake drives air underground through a network of pipes that quickly cools the air to the temperature of the soil, where it reaches 100% humidity and produces water. The water is then stored in an underground tank and pumped through the roots of the crops via a subsurface drip irrigation hosing. Edward Linacre worked with Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne, where he graduated with a degree in industrial design. He developed his invention in his honours year. He started the project after newspaper reports of weekly suicides by drought-stricken farmers. To find the solution, he looked to the deep past where tribesmen would cool their huts with small underground tunnels. They were using the soil underground to cool the air, but water was also produced, and they had to create catchments. So he thought, that's the one. Initial experiments with highly temperature-conductive copper piping to condense water vapour from the air weren't successful until copper wool was inserted to maximise the condensation area. Similarly, the desert rhubarb can harvest 16 times the amount of water than other plants in its region by using deep water channeling cavities in its leaves. The air intake turbine runs on wind when it's windy and on storage battery when it's not. Solar power is used to pump the water to the plant's roots and to charge the storage battery. AirDrop can harvest over 10 millilitres of water for every cubic metre of air in the driest deserts, such as the Negev in Israel, which has an average relative air humidity of 64%. A small-scale model that he installed at his parents' house created about a litre of water a day, but future versions of the design are expected to condense much more water. His AirDrop has won the 2011 James Dyson Award and £10,000 as prize from the James Dyson Foundation. This will be matched by Swinburne University. He plans to use the prize to scale the invention to agricultural size to help farmers around the world protect their soil and water, protect their soil and water their crops regardless of what happens to the weather. A new treatment for children suffering progeria may also reverse some of the causes of ageing. The ageing of cells taken from children with Hutchinson-Gilford progeria syndrome, HGPS, has been reversed with a drug normally given to people who've taken too much paracetamol, N-acetylcysteine. The research was conducted at Durham University in Britain. This is a rare genetic condition in which huge amounts of DNA damage cause cells to quickly age and die. As a result, babies grow old and frail before dying of old age between the ages of 8 and 21. Many of the problems of progeria, such as hardening of the arteries, stiffness of the joints, and hip dislocations, are also present in normal aging. So therefore, N-acetylcysteine may have a more general use. Most people live much of the last 10 years of their life with a disability. N-acetylcysteine comes from the amino acid L-cysteine. It's currently used for a wide variety of problems from chronic bronchitis to liver damage. It's used by injection, as an inhalant, and in pill form. It's also sold as a food supplement. And with me in the studio is Martin Ficini and Patrick Ruby.
Yeah, N-acetylcysteine is a bit of a panacea in medicine. I've seen it used in cystic fibrosis as a way to break up mucus in people's lungs. Its most evidence-based use is in the treatment of acute liver hepatitis and paracetamol overdose. But it's sort of a bit overrated in its ability to reduce oxidative stress, and that's its main mechanism. So what it does is when you have an oxidative load, which is one of the mechanisms of aging, you use up an enzyme in the body called glutathione, and N-acetylcysteine will help the body regenerate that ability to break down free radicals. But it is interesting, and progeria, you see it on TV, but you really rarely see it in the world. But it's such a debilitating, devastating disease. Anything that can help these kids live a better life is got to be good, and hopefully it turns out to be a better treatment than it is for some of the indications where it hasn't really stacked up against the evidence.
Sorry, I'm thinking about cats again.
And now Martin Ficini brings us the latest on our mind-controlling parasite overlords.
New research from the University of Leeds has demonstrated that a common parasite can alter the amount of dopamine present in the brains of infected mice. Dr. Glenn McConkie's team found that mouse neurons infected by Toxoplasma produce significantly more dopamine than unaffected neurons. This work builds on previous research that found the Toxoplasma genome encodes the enzyme responsible for the synthesis of dopamine, an important neurotransmitter. Dopamine is one of the most important molecules in the brain, responsible for coordinating movement, stimulating our reward centers, and influencing cognition. It is closely related to the development of diseases such as schizophrenia, Parkinson's, and bipolar disorder. Understanding how Toxoplasma influences dopamine could help us understand how these diseases begin and offer new ways to treat them. The parasite, Toxoplasma gondii, or Toxo for short, is a single-celled protozoa that can infect a wide variety of animals, including humans. It is estimated that up to a third of the world's population harbors the parasite with minimal symptoms. Toxo only poses a serious health risk to people with weakened immune systems and pregnant women. Like any parasite, Toxo has to find a way to move from one host to another, and the ways it has evolved to do so are diabolically clever. Toxo can only sexually reproduce in the digestive system of cats. It's no surprise, then, that Toxo commonly infects mice. However, the parasite then alters the expression of dopamine in key areas of the mouse brain responsible for fear and sexual arousal. Instead of an innate terror when exposed to cat odor, the amygdala, or fear center of the brain, responds by increasing neural activity in regions of the brain normally activated by mice of the opposite sex. Dysfunction of the amygdala and improper emotional responses are commonly associated with schizophrenia. In fact, some studies have found sufferers of schizophrenia are more likely to be infected by Toxo than the general population. The exact relationship between Toxo infection and the development of schizophrenia is unknown, but Toxo could influence our behavior in more subtle ways. Toxo's effects in humans are likely a byproduct of its intended effect on mice, but considering how commonly it infects us, how much of our behavior stems from a single-celled parasite churning out dopamine in our brains?
there's a few things there. When we've talked about this subject before, one of the things that came up was, of course, you always have to wonder, now that we know that it's the sexual attraction that brings the rats back to the cats, what would happen if they didn't get eaten first?
Well, it could just be associated with, like, risk-taking behavior.
Well, it seems to be more than that. I mean, there is risk-taking in there, but the evidence seems to be that they feel the fear and the sexual attraction. And, of course, it's not just rats. Humans get infected with toxoplasmosis gondii as well. And so maybe some of these world leaders that are caught in really risky sexual situations that could just completely destroy their careers feel the fear and do it anyway.
Maybe should have Servio, a toxoplasmosis screen.
Maybe Servio Berlusconi could have been saved from leaving the Italian parliament if he'd just been treated for his toxo.
If only we had a treatment.
Yeah, if only we had cats that could just gobble him up.
I love cats. Sorry, I'm getting emotional. I love cats. I love every kind of cat. Sorry, I really love cats. And I just want to hug all of them, but I can't, because that's crazy. I can't hug every cat. But I just want to, I want to. I'm sorry, anytime I hear cat, I love cats. Promised myself I wouldn't cry. So anyway, I am a cat lover, and I love to run. I'm sorry, I'm thinking about cats again. I think about how many don't have a home, and how I should have them, and how cute they are, and their ears, and the whiskers, and the nose. I just love them, and I want them, and I want them in a basket, and I want little bow ties. I want them to be on a rainbow, and just in my bed, and I just want a house full of them, and I just want to still roll around. I can't.
You're listening to Diffusion Science Radio. Send email to diffusion@2ser.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network, in Sydney on 2SER 107.3, and over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. Next, Patrick Ruby tells us why your body odour is sexy.
I'm not much of a morning person, but I've managed to get into a routine to survive them. I get up, jump into the shower for 5 or 10 minutes, jump out, dry myself, spray on some deodorant, have a quick shave, rub on some aftershave, grab some toast, and head off to work. But this morning I'd actually run out of deodorant and had to use an old spare can in the back of my bathroom cabinet that I hadn't used in years. Didn't smell that good, unfortunately. The last time I bought some deodorant, I ended up trying out 3 or 4 different sprays, agonized over what I thought were minute differences, and then ended up buying the one I always buy. Sounds a little pathetic, I suppose. But then I started to wonder about 2 things. How are our favourite fragrances made? And what is it that compels us to smell like instinct, or Africa, or ice? Getting from lab to market is actually pretty complicated, so I consulted some sources in chemical engineering to get the picture. Traditionally, many natural ingredients have been used to make perfume, such as flowers, fruits, woods, herbs, and spices. The natural scents can be extracted from these ingredients by steam distillation, solvent extraction, or simple crushing. One disadvantage with this is that the same natural products will actually produce a variety of different scents depending on where they grow and what time of year it is. Natural ingredients also have the potential to cause allergic reactions in people, which could be a big problem. So it's actually more efficient to produce synthetic scents for our perfumes that are close to natural ingredients, stay the same between different batches, and don't produce allergic reactions. The people responsible for creating perfume are called, you guessed it, perfumers. They can train for 9 years or more to perfect their scent-making abilities. Perfumers are usually presented with an idea of what the scent needs to convey. They then let their creative juices flow and make a mood board to try and determine what the scent should represent. The International Fragrance Association regulates the perfume industry, so before the perfumers can start mixing their chemicals, they have to make sure the products will be safe to use. A palette of many different chemicals is used to create the final scent. A reference sample is also used for comparison. The perfumers mix the chemicals they need to make the scent, and then the scents are tested by mass spectrometer and gas chromatograph. This is to make sure the chemical components are correct. The perfumers then do their own smell test to make sure the new scent doesn't differ too much from the reference. Software programs have also been created to help perfumers to work out the exact quantity of individual chemicals they need from a palette of ingredients. The final scent is then evaluated and tested by a panel of customers and sent off for manufacture, packaging, and shipping. And then to the aisles of Coles or Woolies, where they eventually end up in my shopping bag. Science. So that's how they're made. Now, why do we want them at all? Is it simply to mask our own disgusting body odour? A recent London conference held by the International Fragrance Association has expressed some interesting ideas about what fragrances we find attractive. One of the presenters, Dr. Jan Havlicek, an anthropologist at Charles University Prague, has an interesting theory. We choose fragrances to enhance our own natural scent. He asked 12 volunteers to spray perfume that they had chosen for themselves into one of their armpits. Another perfume was chosen randomly and sprayed into the other armpit. Swabs of the armpits were taken and judged by a panel of 21 women. The results of the study were that the women found the fragrances that were chosen by the individual more attractive than the fragrances that were chosen at random. So what? Dr. Havlicek explained that the assumed science behind choice of fragrance was that we choose a smell we liked to mask our own odour. But this research might indicate that we actually choose a fragrance that complements our own body odour and mixes with it to make it more attractive to others. It's an odd idea to think that body odour might actually be attractive, but there's been a lot of research in the area, and it turns out that perhaps it is. A paper published this year in the Archives of Sexual Behaviour looked at what non-verbal cues could predict behavioural attractiveness. In the study, 20 males were photographed and videotaped. They also had other potential markers of attractiveness sampled, including armpit body odour, body mass index, and index finger to ring finger length ratio. 10 women who were blinded to the samples rated each of the samples, photos and videos on their attractiveness and desire to form a relationship. The researchers found that armpit odour had the best correlation with visual attractiveness and nonverbal behaviour. So what is it about odour that we find attractive? Professor Tim Jacob from the Department of Biosciences at Cardiff University, the UK, might have the answer. He also attended the London conference and suggested that our choice of fragrance is influenced by our immune system. Different immune systems produce different odours. We tend to be attracted to people with different immune systems to our own and repelled by people with a similar immune system. He proposes that this confers a biological advantage. If you pick a partner with different genes for their immune system, you'll have a child with a combination of both. This child has a better chance at survival because it has a broader resistance to disease. This is actually a well-established idea and might be due to a very specific molecule of our immune system, a molecule called MHC. MHC, or Major Histocompatibility Complex, is an important cellular protein used by our immune system. It's determined by a group of genes at a specific site in our chromosomes. It's important in distinguishing self from non-self and helps to initiate some of our immune responses against infections. MHC normally has an extremely high variability in vertebrate animals. This is good because the more variety we have, the more diseases we can fight. Many ideas have been proposed on how we maintain this high variability, and sexual selection is one of them. The relationship between MHC and perfume preference has previously been established. A study was done of students and lab assistants from the University of Bern, Switzerland. 137 male and female subjects were given 36 vials of perfume to smell and then asked which ones they would use. The same people were then sent another 18 vials of perfume and asked again which ones they would use for themselves and also which ones they would use on their partners. The researchers found that people of similar MHCs also chose similar perfumes for themselves. But there was absolutely no correlation between MHCs and perfumes that they chose for their partners. The authors believe this supports the idea that we choose our perfumes to amplify our own body odor and display our immunogenetics, a similar idea to what Dr. Havlicek proposed at the conference. So there you have it, a complex mixture of synthetic chemicals chosen to complement our immune system. These are the smells we like to cover ourselves in at work, after sport, or when we're trying to get lucky out on the town.
I'm sorry, I'm thinking about cats again.
Actually, the research on the MHC made me think of an experiment that needs to be done. I mean, surely, if what we're attracted to is a more exotic MHC odour than the one that we produce or people closely related produce, then what would be most attractive and that you could market is if you find a population that's been cut off from the rest of the world for most of history, and you find a very fit individual or group of individuals there, and you get some odour from them, some MHC, and then you reproduce it massively, you could just totally dominate the world market because everyone would find that attractive.
If the theory is correct,
if the person is fit and the research seems to indicate that people are good at, particularly women are particularly good at determining fit men, and if they're exotic, so that because they've been not in contact, none of their ancestors for a very long time with the rest of humanity, they're very distantly related, so everywhere but Papua New Guinea, they'll do really, really well.
Oh, fantastic. There is one fairly significant exception to this study, though. I think it's actually been highlighted in previous literature before. They've actually found the reverse of this, as in women attracted to similar MHCs, specifically for women on the oral contraceptive pill, or women that, which basically mimics pregnancy, I suppose. They're more attracted to people with odour profiles that are similar to themselves. And this has been found in a couple of studies early on, which have been looking at the whole MHC relationship with odour, and subsequent studies have actually excluded women on the oral contraceptive pill because they think it confounds the results. But one of the reasons put forward for this, one of the theories is that once a woman is pregnant, the best survival for her children is to stay close with her family and to stay close with people from the same region that she comes from. So therefore, her attractiveness or propensity for interaction with people changes so that she favours people that are more similar or people from similar backgrounds to herself. The problems with this theory is that it's very difficult to control such a thing because there's such an enormous interplay of hormones and chemicals and all that sort of stuff going on when you're pregnant that it's very difficult to actually know what the precise mechanism there is.
But what they have found is that couples that get together when the woman's on the pill, when she goes off the pill so that they can conceive, there's two things that can go wrong. One is that she finds she's not attracted anymore because she was attracted to him while she was on the pill and his MHC is actually similar, not different.
Yeah.
And the other is because they're similar, they may not actually be genetically that compatible so that they may have a lot of trouble conceiving once she's off the pill because they weren't actually people who would have normally got together biologically in the first place if she hadn't been on the pill.
It makes me wonder if these people are, if that would change when she was off the pill, then what if they were to take their own perfumes? Would that exaggerate that repulsion that would change after the pill?
More interesting experiment.
Yeah, that's one example where wearing the cologne might hurt you rather than help you.
One of the things that amazed me about this research is it's been going on for so long. Like, the initial animal studies they did were in the 70s, where they found that mice were repelled from other mice that had the same MHCs as themselves. And it was followed up, first of all, in 1995 by a group of scientists led by a guy called Wedekind. And they were the ones that did the initial experiments with T-shirts, where women rated the body odors from T-shirts that men had slipped in overnight. And they tried to control it reasonably well. They chose men of similar age and that sort of stuff. And that was the first sort of test in humans that showed that women preferred odor from men with different MHCs to themselves. And from that, the literature's basically just expanded, and they're at the point now where they're having conferences and talking about perfumes and that sort of stuff.
And that's all from us this time on Diffusion. You can send email to diffusion@2scr.com, that's diffusion@2scr.com, and tell us your thoughts, feelings and stories. If you'd like to be on radio and you live in Sydney, we need more volunteers on Diffusion. Subscribe to our podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com. Contributing to the program were Martin Ficini and Patrick Ruby. I produce Diffusion in the studios of 2SCR 107.3 in Sydney, and Diffusion is broadcast nationally via the Community Radio Network. I'm Ian Wolfe. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Looking at the URL, the first thing that sticks out is the colon. And how about a slashing or cutting sound for the slashes? To complete the experience, we might throw in the HTTP and maybe some kind of download sound. www.diffusionradio.com. Lachlan Watmore on guitar.
Radio.